There's no doubt it's a tough job. A lot of eyes are on him. Today, we're going to find out what Connecticut's new Commissioner of Education is working on and what he has planned. Welcome to the full story on WSHU and online at WSHU.org. I'm Ron Ropiak, and I thank you for being part of our program today. In just a moment, I'm going to be speaking with Education Commissioner Miguel Cardona. But first, I want to mention that if you'd like to comment on the conversation, the best way to do it is by email. We're at tfs@wshu.org, or if you're on Facebook, go to Full Story WSHU, and you could find out about all our shows there and also leave us a comment. Commissioner Cardona, welcome to the Full Story. Thanks for coming on, sir.
Thank you, Ron. Glad to be here.
You've been in your job for, what, a bit over a month now?
A little over a month, right. August 7th, I was sworn in.
Are you glad you took it? I mean, with all respect, it's a hot seat job, isn't it? Every parent, teacher, Board of Ed member, state legislator, everybody's watching what you're doing.
Right. It is a hot seat, but it's a great position to be in. I'm glad to be here and look forward to serving the best I can to help kids in Connecticut. There's a lot of great people here at the State Department of Education and throughout the state, so it will be a team effort.
I should mention that your kids, you have two kids, I believe?
I do.
Okay. They're in the public school system in Meriden, aren't they?
Yes, they are.
All right. And I should mention for those who don't know that you were the assistant superintendent in Meriden. So with that in mind, I'm going to ask you, not as a commissioner, but if you could step back and look at it as a concerned parent, if you could improve the school system in Meriden and your kids' education, what would you do?
Well, for the last 21 years, I served in different capacities, from a teacher to principal, assistant superintendent in Meriden. So I had the task of trying to improve the system and improving the school. The message is the same. Improve core instruction, improve quality teaching, improve the standards, and make sure that students are receiving a rigorous core program. Partner with community agencies who share the same interest in developing children, because as the needs of the children evolve and get more intense, we need to rely on community partners to help in things that schools maybe are not equipped to handle as well, such as mental health support in some cases, or dental support, or whatever it is that they need. But the role of the school system is really to ensure that you have a high quality curriculum program, effective teaching strategies, and connections with students so that they feel engaged in the learning process.
You know, everything is done by rankings nowadays and ratings, right? We're always being compared to others in our personal lives and what we do professionally. If you look at Connecticut and you compare the educational system here to other states, how would you rank it?
I think we're among the best, but there's always room for improvement. We have high-performing students that attend the best universities, that go on to lead and come back in Connecticut and be leaders in Connecticut. But there's still room for improvement. You know, Connecticut has one of the largest gaps in achievement based on either zip code or ethnicity. And that's something that, while we should be proud of the success we've had, and I believe we were ranked in the top three or top five recently, we shouldn't become complacent with some of the gaps that exist, and we should maintain that level of urgency to address that.
You know, you touched on something that I wasn't going to bring up today, but it's an interesting point, because one of the very first programs we did when we started this show back last November was about the graying of Connecticut and how the boomers are just getting older and how a lot of young people are leaving. So you just mentioned that. How do you keep the youngsters here when they finish their education from not going to other states? How do you keep them in Connecticut?
So it's really a holistic approach. Education alone is not going to have the answers. We have to have a robust economy and have places where our graduates are going to come back and lead cities and be a part of a city, much like the larger cities that they may be heading to. We need to have those cities here where our graduates can come back and contribute. I think having a good educational system does that. So when you have an educational system that's in tune with the needs of our state, I think it's much more likely to happen. I feel strongly that a good educational system is the best economic driver for our state. So when you have students that are graduating with the skill set needed to take the jobs that exist now or contribute to the trends in the state of Connecticut, it's more likely they're going to stay here and want to stay here.
Before we get into some of the other questions, I just want to get a little bit of your background and your thought process. Can I ask you why you chose to do what you do? I mean, some teachers have told me in the past that they didn't have a choice. It was in their blood. They had to do it.
So for me, I grew up in a house with my father was a police officer. My brother ended up becoming a police officer. I have an older brother, a younger sister by 2 years. Public service was in our DNA. Both of my parents, hardworking parents, who have contributed to local things in Meriden and are part of the community. So service was something that I knew I wanted to do. I ended up attending a technical high school. My older cousin attended a Wilcox Technical High School, and I liked it. I went into that same high school, and I learned through my experience. I went in and had a positive experience with one of my teachers there, who really inspired me to want to consider becoming an art teacher. So my initial thought was to go into to be a teacher, an art teacher, but I gravitated toward elementary education. It really ignited a passion to serve children, help children develop and grow and reach their potential. So I became an elementary school teacher. I was fortunate enough to receive a call from the superintendent of the town where I lived asking me to apply for a position, and I did. I worked there. I then was prodded by administration to consider principalship. And I did that, and I was blessed to serve as a principal in a school that served children with autism. We had a program for children with autism. We had a program for 3 and 4 year olds with developmental delays. We had a program for children that are coming from other countries and needed bilingual services. So it was really a melting pot. It was I used to call it Little Ellis Island. We served all children, and that was a wonderful experience. I was fortunate to earn the National Distinguished Principal in 2012. That position really made me want to expand my scope, and I went into central office administration after my doctorate work, I did that for 6 years, and this opportunity to become Commissioner of Education came up, and I took it.
Commissioner, now you could do it on a statewide basis, so can you give us your top 5 priorities?
Sure. So, there's no shortage of good ideas in Connecticut, and I think one of the key things is making sure that we create a network of interdependence so that we can learn from what's working in Connecticut. No shortage of ideas. So establishing a network of inter-district support and inter-district collaboration that not only share best practices, but wherever possible, look for efficiencies and opportunities for students that might not exist in some of our smaller communities. Addressing the achievement disparities is critical. Making sure that at the end of my time here, I can say that we made a dent or closed the achievement gaps in Connecticut. It's unfortunate, but it's a fact that more affluent Black students perform worse than poor white students. So when we talk about achievement disparities being a poverty thing, poverty does contribute significantly, but we can't leave it there. We do have to examine other causes of it and try to turn that into strategies to engage students better and make sure that all students feel welcome and successful in schools. Part of that, Ron, is looking at our core curriculum. So I would say the third thing might be to develop a more robust core curriculum for the districts that don't have one, because you can have the best teachers, you could have the best resource district, but if the curriculum tools that you use, the materials you put in front of kids, is not high quality, the students will underperform always. So we want to make sure that when we talk about going back to the instructional core, we have good teaching, we have good materials, and we have connections with students. A couple other areas that I want to highlight is the potential that there exists to create stronger partnerships with the colleges and universities. Many of our students are able to access college-level courses earlier and get them on the pathway to college earlier. So for the juniors and seniors that are highly committed and are looking for a pathway to college, why not give them opportunities to take college courses in high school? Why not partner with them so that they can even save some money when they get to college because they've taken credits at the high school level? That's an area that can be explored and expanded on much more. Another is partnership with businesses. So there are workforce needs right now that if we don't change the structure of how we do business, will be unmet. Those workforce needs would be unmet. So we have we know we have jobs in Connecticut that require a certain skill set. And I don't believe at this point we're doing an adequate job preparing our workforce for those jobs that exist. And when we talk about keeping people in Connecticut, one of the ways to do that is to make sure that they're fully employed in Connecticut, right? We don't want to promote graduates going and being underemployed or working 2 to 3 jobs to try to make ends meet when there are advanced manufacturing jobs that exist here in Connecticut that we can do a better job preparing our students for.
Commissioner, any parent with a kid in school nowadays is going to tell you that obviously they're always looking for a host of improvements. They want their kid to get the best. It's been that way for a long time. But if we're going to be honest, nowadays, school safety, I think, is at the top of the list for parents. School safety, what's being done to ensure safe schools, and how to deal with the stress and the anxiety. Can you comment on that?
I can. I'm a parent first. I have a sophomore in high school. I have an eighth grader in middle school. I drop off my son in the morning, and as a parent, I want to make sure my child is safe. That matters most. I last night shared with my children before they went to bed the public service announcement that was put forth by Sandy Hook Promise.
I just watched it this morning. Isn't that powerful?
It was touching. It was chilling, and it was important that I share it with them. And listen to what they thought. So at the end of the day, it's critically important. Our primary responsibility is to ensure safety in children. And that safety means physical safety, but also emotional safety. Our schools, as we evolve our schools, we need to ensure that teachers have the tools to meet the emotional needs and support students the way they need to be supported and help students identify their emotions and communicate them in a way that can get them the help that they need when they need it. Yes, definitely important that we continue to grow and continue to improve on ensuring safe environments for students. And that's not just physical, but also emotional safety.
You mentioned emotional safety twice in what you just said. And just the other day, we spoke with a New York State senator who is proposing mental health days for students. Is that something Connecticut should consider?
So whether or not they're called mental health days, I think if students are having concerns that are not visible to their their peers or their teachers, we should have an avenue for them to communicate that they have concerns, and we should get them the help. Oftentimes, for many students, as you know, the best support they're going to get is within the school walls, right? So while rest or being home if you're ill is something that they should consider if they're not feeling well or if they can't be there emotionally, I think I would encourage students to be in school and get the support that they need within the building and with the teachers and school social workers and guidance counselors or school counselors that are there and trained to address those needs.
You mentioned the same concerns that some of our guests said on that program. They said it sounds good in theory, and every kid should get the assistance that they need. But in the meantime, the schools have been dealing with this for quite some time, and they have the structure in place.
They do. They have the structure in place. And quite frankly, it used to be that we had 2 to 3 people in the school that are trained in de-escalation or trained in providing that emotional support. The reality is now everyone in the building need to have some level of training in how to look for signs of stress in kids. Kids are much more stressed these days than ever before. They have so much to think about. And in some cases, that absenteeism, right? So let's say students miss school because they're feeling unhappy or don't want to be there. Now they have the stress of the attendance issues that if they miss school, now they're going to be missing work and it's going to pile on. So When I said earlier, making sure that we invest in giving teachers the tools that they need to be successful, part of that is helping them understand how to support students who exhibit behaviors in their classroom due to stress or other trauma that the child might have had. So professional learning for teachers, professional development opportunities for teachers, really important part of giving them the tools that they need to be successful. And it's not relegated to social workers. It's not relegated to school psychologists. All teachers need to be aware of at least the signs so they could support the children or at least get support for the students when they show signs that they need it.
Why is there so much stress nowadays? Is that the way our society is, or are children simply a reflection of us as parents, you know, over-caffeinated, you know, working 2-3 jobs, going all the time?
You know, I've been in the field of education for 20 years, and I do see a sense of stress and a sense of, I have to make sure my transcripts look good for college. I have to make sure that I'm hitting straight A's. Like, there's so much pressure on kids that sometimes when I have conversations with students, I'm like, listen, high school should be fun. Take classes that you would never have a chance to take again. Try something different. And I think, you know, kind of in letting them know that that's okay is critically important too. But there is a lot more stress in schools, and I think, you know, I've heard schools are the psychological emergency rooms of society. So whatever's happening outside of school is happening inside of school. We get it all. We see it all. Because I remember when in the late 2000s, you know, when the economy took a downturn, we saw that in our schools. I was a principal then, and I saw the effect that it had on families when, you know, someone lost their job and the stressor that it put on the student in the building. So whatever's happening out in society is spilling into our schools, and we get it in a raw form with youngsters ages 4 to 17. You know, so we're not immune to what's happening in society. And the more stress there is in society, the more fast-paced or there is an effect.
I remember when my son was in grammar school, and I was talking with a few of the parents outside of the school one day. You know, we were there to pick up the kids, and they were talking about all the classes that they had planned and all the extracurricular activities for their kids at that very early age to set them up to get into college. Yeah, and I remarked, isn't this crazy? I mean, college is way off in the future at this point. And they just looked at me, and they were like, Ron, get with it. This is the way it is now.
Right. You know, part of the plan for me is to sit down with admissions, sit down with presidents of the universities to have this conversation to say, what are you looking for? And I've had conversations with parents similar to your conversation. What are you looking for? A well-rounded student, a student that can try different things, a student that might not be the best athlete but has tried different sports, a student that might do well academically but is also willing to try different courses and have a well-rounded critical thinking experience. So I think we need to do a better job promoting those skills also so that, you know, we don't have students like a student that I spoke to last month who told me, man, I really want to take a personal finance course because I think it'll help me in my life, but I'm not going to take it because it's not a weighted course. And if I take it, it'll hurt my GPA, and that would hurt my transcript. We're doing something wrong when I have a high school senior telling me, I really want personal finance, but I'm afraid to take it because it's going to hurt my GPA. There's a problem there because that young lady who wants to study to be a neuroscientist will need personal finance for her own personal finance, but it would be a good skill for her to have in whether it's neuroscience or whatever she chooses to do. So those are some of the conversations that I want to have when I talk about partnering with colleges, communicating what students should consider when in high school. But it's a very competitive, unfortunately, you know, there's good and bad to it, right? We want students to achieve high levels. We want students, I talked to you earlier about opening college access in high school, right? So I want there to be opportunities, but I don't want it to be at the detriment of students developing who they are, their voice, and experiencing things that they might not otherwise experience, like a course in a subject that they would never think to do, or taking a language, or having experiences in the community, volunteering instead of having to be so immersed in structured extracurricular sports or clubs. So there should be a balance.
Commissioner, you touched on this before, and as we all know, Connecticut has been trying to fix the inequality and the racial imbalance in education in the state for decades now, and the lawsuits and the legal battles are still going on as we speak. We had a program recently where all the guests, every single one of them, said they felt the only way to fix the ongoing problem was with the school district reorganization and redistricting plan. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I'm really a big proponent of even incentivizing innovative practices that allow districts to share services or work together to provide more opportunities and more access to kids. At the Governor's Roundtable last month, I heard from a student named Abby who said, you know, there's a course that I really want to take, but my school doesn't offer it. It's too small. But a school a quarter mile away from a different district does offer it. I wish I could take that course there. And I'm thinking to myself, if Abby can tell me that's a good idea and the opportunity exists for her to take that class, how can I as commissioner promote those practices? I think we need to look at the idea of sharing best practices across district lines as a start. We know, as I said earlier, there's no shortage of good ideas in Connecticut. You know, somebody's issue in one district has already been solved in someone else's district. So my question is, how do I do a better job creating lines of communication and sharing best practices so that there could be that intrinsic motivation to learn and partner with sister districts or neighboring districts and provide more opportunity for students who might otherwise not have opportunities.
Obviously, you know, the Lamont administration tried to get the conversation going on this a short time back, and it got shot down in no time. Should they try again?
You know, when I talk to educators, I talk to district leaders, they are looking for opportunities to blur the lines, to work with colleagues, to give opportunities to their own students. I do think there's a interest in collaborative shared practices. I do believe that does exist, and I think I'm going to be looking for practices that, and we do have them. We do have them in our state. We have to do a better job promoting those, removing barriers where opportunities exist for districts to work together, and promoting, even if it's through incentivizing some seed money so that they can think about how to provide more opportunities for kids across lines. I think that's the approach to take. You know, let's start with the kid in mind. And what can we do to help kids? And I'll be honest with you, I know we have it happening already in Connecticut, and I know it'll continue if we look at it from the perspective of how can we help children the best. And I think everyone that I've spoken to feels strongly that we need to be innovative in order to address some of these issues that have been plaguing Connecticut for the last 30 years. And I'm speaking specifically about the achievement gaps.
One of the issues that's been plaguing Connecticut for years deals with the budget, especially when it comes to paying for pensions. And this has been going on, again, for decades. So the governor is looking for more public-private partnerships to help the state out. And the one that's gotten the most attention involves Ray Dalio. He and his wife are going to give I think it's $100 million to the state. It'll be matched by $100 million from the state, and then another $100 million is going to be raised from private sources. And a lot of the money is going to be used to help disadvantaged students finish high school. Is this a good idea? Should we have more of these partnerships?
You know, we're fortunate in Connecticut to have Dalio family step up and say, I'm going to put my money where my mouth is. I'm going to put something forward to help address these issues. So I look at it as a positive thing, and the more we can partner, it still takes a village to raise a child, right? So we have our business community that's stepping up and philanthropists that are saying, I really want to commit to making a difference for the lives of children. Again, a strong educational program is the best economic driver for our state. So I'm happy about that investment, and I know that it will ultimately help children achieve at higher levels. So I'm pleased that we have that opportunity. I haven't had a chance yet to meet or be invited to any conversations on that. I don't think any has happened yet, but I look forward to, as commissioner, not only leading the agency to address achievement disparities, but also partnering in ways that could ultimately lead to the same outcome.
So speaking of money, talk to us about the budget. Do you have the money you need to do the job that you want to do?
So I can tell you that we would always welcome more resources to put toward the strategies that we know work. But I'll tell you, Ron, it's really important for me, especially at the onset of this job, to make sure that we're utilizing the money that we are receiving the best way we can. You know, we're stewards of public money. We have to make sure that we're using it toward the goals that we have set out. And I'm embarking on a process now where I'm reviewing how we're using our grants and are we getting a return on investment for what we're putting our resources, where we're putting our resources. That's critically important for me. Before asking for another dollar, I want to make sure that the money that I am getting is being used to help children succeed throughout the state.
Commissioner, you're Connecticut's first Latino state education commissioner. What does that mean to you? And I ask that question with this in mind. We had Chief Justice Richard Robinson on the program the other day, and he's the first African-American to be Chief Justice of the Connecticut Supreme Court. And he says he's always aware of that. Is it difficult being first?
Let me tell you, it's the greatest honor. I think of the sacrifice my grandparents made when they left the beautiful island of Puerto Rico, a little paradise, to come work the tobacco field here in Hartford. Because my grandfather was a sugar cane farmer, and he used those skills to cut tobacco here. And they formed, they came here to work, and, you know, two generations later, I'm able to lead the State Department of Education. So it's not lost on me, humbled by that opportunity, eager to serve as the commissioner for all children in every city, but it's not lost on me that as the first Latino, I have a lot of young Latinos that are looking at me and saying, wow, I could do that too. So it's not lost on me, and it's something that I wear with pride.
Are the students looking at you differently nowadays? What about your kids?
My kids are proud, but listen, I'm still poppy to them. At the end of the day, they still need me to sign the forms. They still, you know, want me to take them to practice and not be late. And I like that. I like being Papi at home, and they're proud of me, and they were here for the swearing in, and I think they realize that hard work, dedication, and passion, and faith will take you wherever you need to go.
Just like any other kids, huh? That title doesn't mean all that much. You're still dad.
Right, right, exactly.
Hey, how long do you think it's going to take you to do? I mean, you have an ambitious agenda, which is fantastic. How long do you think it'll take you to achieve what you want to achieve?
Well, you know, there's no beginning, there's no end. The work is never done. You know, that's one thing I learned when I was principal. I'm never going to be done. The work, I want to be aggressive. We need it. We need it in Connecticut. We need action. We need to make sure that we're writing our narrative. I want to make sure that we have a good offense, that we have a good strategy. I'm a month in right now, and I'm already getting anxious because I'm still working the budget, trying to figure out the organizational chart here. I really want to get going on these strategies that I think are going to help our kids, and I'm eager to get going. It's never going to be done. I think we have to be aggressive in the beginning to make sure that we're clear on what our expectations are, but the work doesn't end. It's continuous improvement. We need to be reflective. The moment we think it ends, we're susceptible to falling because we're overconfident. So there's going to be a constant process of evaluating what we're doing, seeing if we're getting a good return on investment, and ensuring that we're moving and evolving the way our state needs us to evolve. I feel like, you know, we can be happy with progress when we say that our high schools are producing the workforce that we need and are getting students not only to be enrolled in college, but to finish college. So those are some things that I'd like to see progress on. I'd like to see gaps closing. I'd like to see them closing. That's telling me we're on the right track. Mm-hmm. I'd like to see higher graduation rates. I'd like to see higher SAT scores. I want students to be better prepared. Whether they go into college or career, their earning potential is going to grow the better we prepare them. So while the job's not going to be done, those are some progress points that I want to see.
Thank you, Commissioner. We appreciate your time. I hope you come back in the future.
Thank you, Ryan. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Same here. Bye. It's the full story on WSHE. We'll take a break. We'll be right back. It's the full story on WSHU and online at WSHU.org. I'm Ron Ropiak, and as always, I thank you for being part of our show. Without you, there's no full story. And if you have the time today and you're on Facebook, give us a look. We're at Full Story WSHU. We're continuing with our talk about education. I was just speaking with the Connecticut Commissioner of Education, Miguel Cardona. He's been in office in place now a little over a month or so. Now we have three more guests to round out our discussion. Gwen Samuel is joining us on the phone. Gwen is the founder of Connecticut Parents Union. Hey, Gwen, how are you?
Good afternoon, WHSU.
Or WSHU, even better. We just do that to make sure that people are paying attention. Also on the phone with us is Jeff Leek. Jeff is the president of the Connecticut Education Association. Hi, Jeff. How are you?
And good afternoon to all of you as well.
Good afternoon. And Don Williams is back with us. Don is the executive director of the Connecticut Education Association. Don, pleasure to have you back. How are you?
Hey, Ron. Doing very well. Thanks very much, and great to be with you.
It's our pleasure, as always. Gwen, I would to start with you, if you don't mind. What should be the number one item on the commissioner's agenda after making sure, obviously, that all students are safe? What should be job number one?
Well, number one, he will have to build relationships. So it's not necessarily number one. It needs to run parallel with his day-to-day activities. And that is engaging and building relationships with the families and the parents of the children he will serve. Because the children do not start their day in the classroom. They come from homes, shelters, foster care. So to say that you're just going to engage students alone is just setting himself up for a rough road.
Very interesting. Jeff, what would your number one item be?
My number one item would probably be, again, the safety of students and a professional workforce, but more importantly, or most importantly for us right now, is working on the issue of diversity, diversity of our student body, how it's changed over time, and the diversity that we hope to achieve in our teaching force as well. And we hope to work with the commissioner on those items, certainly.
And Don Williams, your number one, please.
I would build on what our speakers have said, and in addition to diversity, equity. I think that we've got one of the best school systems overall in the country. However, just because we place in the top five out of the 50 states doesn't mean that we do not have severe gaps between the resources of some of the schools in our most challenged and economically depressed areas, both urban and rural. And we need to make sure we're delivering the resources and the opportunities that all of our children need across the state.
Gwen, I would like to build on that, please. We had a program recently where we took a look at the lawsuit Chef versus O'Neill and where we are 30 years later. All the guests on the program said the state has to look at school district regionalization and reorganization to deal with what we were just talking about with racial and educational inequality and to save money. Now, as you know, the state lawmakers tried that. They got shut down. As soon as they got started, it was a non-starter. My question to you is, should they try again? Is this the best way to go?
Well, number one, the reason why they were shot down is because they underestimated the power of the residents that live in those very towns. And this is really about force versus educational freedom, versus the autonomy that towns have to do what is best for the residents in their town. So the problem with all of this, Chef, good intentions with Chef, but we're talking about a 30-year-old lawsuit that says that the only way that black and brown children can learn, and I'm paraphrasing, is to sit next to white and Asian children. It's not about the color of the educator that ensures quality instruction. It's about the competencies of the individual in front of the classroom, regardless of their skin color. I believe we're talking in sound bites. I'm talking from the perspective of a black parent who benefits from, you know, my children benefit when they have access to a quality school. But I believe we're playing politics with the rhetoric of we're just improving, increasing diversity. It's bigger than that. And regionalization will always get attacked from the towns as long as you don't include them in the conversations. And at the end of the day, it should be about encouraging volunteerism among towns to collaborate resources, to ensure outcomes, not the government, not partisan politics wanting to do it to make everyone feel good and things like that. This is bigger than just the rhetoric of regionalization and diversifying classrooms. Race doesn't improve quality. Competencies and partnerships and working with families and children do.
Jeff Leek, as president of the Connecticut Education Association, your thoughts, please, on school district regionalization and reorganization. And my other question, part two to this, is should it be all carrot and no stick?
Well, no, I don't believe it needs to be all carrot and no stick. But the bottom line is this. The reason our school systems are not equitable is because of the housing patterns in our state, because of the fact that we have isolated places where there's diversity and then places where there's pretty much not any diversity. And my feeling would be that we have to continue to look at opportunities that allow students to grow. I've listened to the Connecticut treasurer a couple of times now talk about his opportunity as a student who involved in a busing program and so forth, and that helped him out a lot, but not all of our students can be there. So we need to look at societal problems that bring these problems of non-diversity and non-equitable education in our state.
Don Williams, as the former president of the state Senate, would this have any chance whatsoever of getting passed if mandated? And if you tell me it doesn't have a chance, then should they just shelve it? And because it's politically unworkable, and if it's shelved, what should they try and work on then? How should they make it work?
Well, you know, this is a completely different kind of entity that I'm going to talk about, but judge of probate districts were successfully regionalized, and it involved a lot of folks working together, starting with the different towns, and at one point every town had a judge of probate, and that was unsustainable. So folks worked together. They figured out how can we regionalize, how can we share services, but it wasn't done, you know, with a shotgun. It wasn't done with just simply a club. There were carrots, but what was really important was that there were discussions about how to figure it out. A school district is a whole lot more complicated than a judge of probate district. So that means that there are a lot more things to figure out in terms of what services can be shared, et cetera. But bottom line, it's got to start with how do we ensure a quality education for a student? How do we improve neighborhood schools that serve students close to where they live? Those are things that parents care about. Those are things that are important in terms of an excellent first-rate education of a child.
So just to refresh everyone's memory, when the reorganization was first started to be talked about a number of months ago, what Connecticut did with probate served as if you will, the base model for what the state wanted to do with education. Don?
Yeah, well, like I said, you're never going to have an apples-to-apples thing here, but what it really did start with, and this did not happen overnight, was going to all those districts, having people come together and talk about how do we put this together in a way that works for the districts that are being served. You can't just simply say, look, we're going to put a bunch of towns together that may or may not share interests, or it may or may not make sense to have people working toward this goal. There's got to be shared common interests. And Ron, I think you have to start with the neighborhood schools that serve children and build rings outward from that, because it doesn't make sense to take what works in Connecticut and to toss that away. We need to go into communities, listen to the parents, listen to the students, and figure out how we can make those neighborhood schools better. And in some cases, especially in Connecticut, where you have a number of small towns where their high schools have been shrinking in student population, and that's narrowing options for those students, where it is time for those towns to have conversations about how can we work together with surrounding towns. And once you start those discussions, as we did with the judge of probate consolidation, you can make progress and get somewhere.
Gwen Samuel, can we talk about something that Don Williams was just touching on? We need to look at some numbers, don't we? The birth rate in Connecticut is declining. Young people are leaving. The state is getting grayer. So what does this mean for the future of our state schools? How should we be planning for the future?
Well, again, the two things he said key. He said parents, he said communities, towns, working together. And see, it's one thing to say it. But in real time, most of these plans happen in secret, out of the ears and out of the eyesight, out of the communities. And so here we are, you know, government, quote-unquote, experts saying this is what we're going to do. But creating an informed citizenry, right, creating informed neighborhoods is to have these tough conversations. Most people resist what they don't know, right, what they don't have access to. Data matters in this case. But again, it's always other people making decisions behind closed doors. That includes the Dalio deal, right? That includes these regionalizations. And then you spring it on the taxpayers who have to foot the bill. So no matter the choices you make, when you make bad choices, the taxpayers of Connecticut have to pay. When you make good choices, then there's a return on the investment of the taxpayers. And at the end of the day, our investment is what supports public education. But again, it's about checks and balances. It's about including the very people. This regionalization wanted to go in and then use black and brown communities as the excuse. I was offended as a black mom saying that we should go dismantle great schools in these smaller towns to, you know, force integration to help other children. No, we don't sacrifice the well-being of one child to help another child. We ensure every single Connecticut child has access to safe, quality educational experiences. So what the government will have to do, what our legislators will have to do, what our, you know, our partnerships with unions will have to do is include the people in the conversation, because the people who know best about their neighborhood are the people who live in the neighborhood.
Jeff Leake, we have 4 minutes left in our program. So can we talk a little bit about money and funding? The state owes billions for its pensions. The transportation system needs billions. Where's the money going to come from to build an even better state educational system?
Well, regarding pensions, that issue, I think, is becoming more manageable as we've moved forward. Just recently, of course, the teacher retirement system has been stabilized over the course of its lifetime. But in terms of the money that should be available in this state, we are, if not one, number two of a wealthiest state in the nation, and we've got to figure out how to put together a tax system that doesn't take advantage of low-income and middle-income folks, but does take advantage of the absolute wealth that is in this state and should be available for public education in Connecticut.
A higher tax rate on the wealthy?
Perhaps. Perhaps a complete look at and redo of our tax system about how we fund essential services in the state of Connecticut. And that, again, going back to what's been said already in this conversation, needs to be done with building relationships and having conversations. And that doesn't mean conversations that begin in January because there's a session and end in June because it's over.
Don Williams, where does the money come from, please?
Well, Jeff is right. Connecticut's one of the wealthiest states in the Milky Way galaxy, not just the United States. So we do have the means to move forward. We found those means in the past. But you also have to think of what we're spending those dollars on. We're spending it on perhaps the greatest resource for our children and our adults in terms of continuing education that's out there, and that's education. And we're doing it, we need to do this, and we need to be better at it in terms of the dollars that we provide at perhaps the most critical time in human history in terms of investing in education. The pace of technology is just moving at a speed that we've never seen before. And so in order to be able to be competitive, as we have been in the past, to be a leader in exports, as we have been today and in the past, and have a thriving economy that speaks to the future of this state and our country, we have to invest in education.
Gwen Samuel, we have 1 minute left, and that means you have the final say when it comes to saying, where should the money come from?
You can have a money tree growing in the yard, but if you are not spending, it's not wealth. We're talking about individuals who worked hard. The wealth of Connecticut is the people. It's the hard-working people who invest through taxes. So you just can't say have a new flavor of the month and then say we're going to pay for it. You have to be fiscally responsible. You have to be accountable to the people and how you are spending the money. We are wealthy today, but that could change as people exit Connecticut because of the way we are not being held accountable. We're not being fiscally responsible. So again, as I close, it's not about the wealth of Connecticut. It's how you're spending the wealth of Connecticut. And it begins with protecting the taxpayers' investment for a good return on investment.
I want to thank all of you for joining me today on this program from this part of the Milky Way galaxy. Gwen Samuel. Gwen is the founder of Connecticut Parents Union. Jeff Leake is the president of the Connecticut Education Association. And Don Williams is the executive director of the Connecticut Education Association. Thank you all. It was a pleasure.
Thank you,
Ron.
Be well. If you'd like to comment on today's program, you can drop us an email. We're at tfs@wshu.org. On Facebook, you can find us at Full Story WSHU, and you could leave us a comment there also. That's going to do it for our show today. Julie Ferdino is our engineer. Carrie Frank is the digital editor. Our associate producers are Fatou Sangari, Sabrina Garone, Roberto Rojas. J.D. Allen is the producer, and Lopez is the senior producer. And Terry Sheridan is our news director. I'm Ron Ropiak. Thanks to you, space travelers, for being part of the Full Story.